Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure for me to be here at Credit Insurance. And the title is a strength of Chris Lyon called Pagonatos, because basically we are in this paper, which should come very soon, which is the second one here. I don't know if I have a point.
August.
I mean, you're not your friend. Okay. Which is this one, done in collaboration with Krishna Tagopa and Rishi Sharma, which is a PhD student of Krishna. We are trying to study the response of so-called crystalline color superconductor to shear and to shear stress. And so we are really trying to study the properties of this system as if it was a solid. And that's my email. I will be here for one day more. So if you want to discuss your, it will be a pleasure for me to discuss with you, or you can contact me by that email address. So this is the outline of my talk. First of all, I will give you some background and some motivations about color superconductivity, why we study this state, this possible state of matter, and some basic features of this this place. Then I will I will introduce a concept of stressing a superconductor, which means that we allow for different chemical potential of the Fermi of the fermions which interact from Cooper pairs, and I will show that I will show some results which point to a magnetic or chromomagnetic instability of the system. I will deal with mostly as a pedagogical thing. I will deal with the two flavor case, and then I will deal with the three flavor case, which is probably the most interesting one from a physical point of view. And then I will discuss the funnels and the shear models in this space. Then my conclusions. For reviews, there are these three articles. I mean, there are many of them. I've just taken the, say, this is the first one of Frank Wilczek and Krishna. The second one is of Mark Alford. The third one is of the recent one of Thomas Schaeffer. And there are some technicalities which are dealt in this article of Giuseppe Nabulli, which was my former advisor. And this did with the so-called LS effective theory, which is quite similar to the heavy quark effective theory. And if I can, I will try to deal a bit with this theory, with this effective theory. So motivations. Why are we interested in a state of matter where the acid density is much larger than the saturation density of normal nuclear matter? And why in a temperature range which is of the order of the KeV, so much smaller than the density scale? Well, the reason is that from a theoretical point of view, we're interested in studying the whole phase diagram of QCD. And maybe we can have some hints about the non-perturbative physics from the perturbative physics, which can be studied, of course, in the high temperature of high, very high density and very high density regime. But also there's a reason that, of course, we can study this phase because the QCD simplifies. I mean, usually the QCD diagram is not so useful because, of course, there's confinement, so quark and gluons are not the effective real degrees of freedom of the theory. But in the high temperature and high density scale, these are the actual degrees of freedom. So you're really studying quark and gluons. And also, there's a third point, which is deals with the experiment, rather with chronological models of compact stellar objects. Well, we will try to understand if in the core of this compact object, neutron stars, density is so large that ions are crushed, and so the quark content is liberated. It's not clear if this is what really can, if this can really happen in the core of neutron stars. But if there is some observable that we can study, as an example, and I will give you some example of that, and if you can make some predictions about this observable, that would be a very good thing. Also, because there are some aspects of the behavior of this stellar object which are not fully explained with standard models. So this is the well-known QCD phase diagram, And this is a cartoon, of course, where you have temperature and density. I mean, it's, and there are basically three phases. It's well known that at extremely high temperature and densities, QCD predicts that at very in this region there is the QGP where quarks and gluons are free, and their interaction is small because alpha strong, of course, in asymptotic energy scales is small. And instead, in the color superconductive phase, we assume that there is a condensate made of quarks, the quark-quark condensate, it's quite different from the mesonic Q-bar Q-condensate, which characterize the hadronic phase. The red region here is quite conservative, and it's the region where non-perturbative effects are relevant. We know that there is such a region. We know that there is a region where even if the quark matter is confined, it is not possible to study this matter with perturbative methods. And the reason is that in our experiments, at least which deal with this region of the phase diagram, and there are lattice simulations which can be done at zero chemical potential. And they predict that there is a crossover in this region here, which is a dashed, and probably you cannot spot it. And then there is probably a phase transition in this other region. And this is probably a first-order phase transition because there's a competition between two different constants, the mesonic and the quark constant. But it can also be different. I mean, there are many possibilities here. I can tell you that it's because lattice can be when you compute as a sample energy density or pressure of quark matter in lattice simulations, you find that the Stefan-Boltzmann result for free gas is not achieved even if you have a temperature of larger 4 Tc. So it is concerning because if this is Tc and if this is linear in T, this is 4 Tc is over there. And so we know that at least at zero chemical potential, there is a huge region where, and also if you try to use a hard thermal loop to predict, to make predictions, you see that you can apply your methods up to 4 Tc, 4 or 5 Tc. I mean, if you have some, I mean, there are some methods, but some, say, perturbative methods, which can apply up to 4 Tc. So we know that at least in this region,
So just in the conservative means that in fact this region
is larger. This is the way in which I meant. And so we assume that also it this is known. I mean, at high temperature, it is not known at low temperature and high densities, because of course we cannot have experiments or lattice simulations for this region on the phase diagram. And this is the region which is interesting for neutral star physics. I mean, we don't know if we can really go into the color superconductive phase with neutral stars, but for sure it is around that value of the density.
Do you know that the phase diagram or the phase boundary actually goes right down to the zero temperature, or is there a
we don't know that.
Could it be a critical point?
We don't know. I mean, you mean this part here?
Yeah, the red strip, is it really all the way down, or does it stop like liquid cask?
this region, you mean if you go up and down? No, we don't know that. I mean, in the sense that you cannot study this. There's no, I mean, the only way you can study this thing is like with NGL models or some phenomenological model. But you cannot have first principle theory for that phase. So that's it is a guess. Instead that we don't know if really non-perturbative physics, but I assume that it is, because I don't see why it should. I mean, there is the strong quark-quark plasma here, strongly coupled quark-quark plasma here. Why there shouldn't be non-perturbative effects at a scale which is basically the same of Tc?
So I wasn't asking what I believe it's not turbid, but I'm just asking as a phase boundary. When you draw that red line, I thought that it was also supposed to be a phase boundary.
Yeah, the year you mean here.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. That probably, I mean, it can also be a crossover also there. I mean, there are some modes here which is a crossover.
I think Rick is asking about the dotted line. Yes, there is a dotted line. There is
here?
Yeah.
Oh, it is dashed here because we know that. We know that it is dashed here. So that it is a crossover.
So it's
okay.
Really like
a liquid. You cannot see. Okay, and so I told that this is dashed here, and it is a crossover. And here there should be a free stop line, uh-huh. And this should be a first order transition. This is the standard view.
So
and it can go down up to here. Yeah, right. It can go down up here. So that's the
at LHC. What will we see at LHC in heavy ion collision?
Oh, you will see a trajectory which goes like this.
Okay. How far will it go along the key axis?
Then it's a matter of defining the temperature. I mean, in the sense that you can very well estimate the energy density of the system,
right.
And you can say that you are about say the critical. I mean, you are about one or two times the critical energy density. But since it is very flat, the energy density profile, I mean, you know, I mean, the energy density as a function of temperature is kind of flat.
Up to 40 C.
Mm-hmm. And so you cannot really go, I don't know, but I would say that you cannot go much into the, assume that the perturbative phase is above 40 C. You cannot reach that.
So basically, you're saying we will not see what we want gas.
Yeah, I think that this is very well. I mean, if this picture can be applied up to 40 C, and if we believe that lattice simulations are correct, and that they are, and if they are telling us that non perturbative physics, sorry for this question, is relevant up to 40 C, LHC cannot go much.
You probably just make a screensaver longer.
Yeah, sorry. I should have said that before. Or I move the mouse. So LHC is, we'll explore, as I was saying, the trajectory is something like this. And then it will say something about 3TC or something like that, and then coming down. So I don't think it will really, I mean, also when people say, I mean, Star or other collaborations, but they say, I mean, we've seen the corpuscular pattern, but the point is, what really have you seen? Because there are some, jet quenching or elliptic flow or all of these things point to the fact that you have a system which is very strongly interactive. So, and the other point is, of course, plasma, we said, in the sense that it's not, you have to characterize, better characterize your system. And I think that LHC will see, many people say that what we will see is just a wonderful collective phenomenon. I mean, very strong collective flow, and this is what we will see. I don't think it will really be able to reach, to produce a weakly interacting quark-gluon plasma. I mean, this is our knowledge. So that's and also the other thing is that, of course, as you know, but now I'm going in a tangent trajectory. I mean, this is also an interesting topic. But the thing is that what we know also about this region is that there are mesonic states which survive above the critical temperature of QCD. So we know that as an example, the J psi. I mean, this is from lattice simulation once again. So there is a good deal there are some approximation data. I mean, you study the correlator on lattice, and then you try to figure out if the mesonic states can survive. And you actually find that the J psi as a sample survives up to 2TC at least. So this means that you don't really have a system of quark gluons there. There are there's other stuff there. And the reason, of course, is that this is not a phase transition at all. This is a crossover. So there's no reason why J psi should disappear at TC or other mesonic states. I mean, and in principle, it seems that the behavior is the mesonic state. The highest temperature of melting of these states. So there are many cases there which is not really understood. It's not really understood which are the degrees of freedom, the basic degrees of freedom of the system. Well, and so on, in the sense that you can then study, I mean, what is the physics of this? I mean, I've done some work in this direction. You can study, for example, if thermalization property, which are missing at RIC, I mean, you find that the system thermalizes, are really driven by mesonic states, as an example. This is one possibility. I mean, scattering in the mesonic states and so fast thermalization. Okay, but let's go back to color superconductor. So this is, as I said, a cartoon, and we are actually interested in this, in this space. So what happens when you have a system of fermions at very low temperature and very high density? Well, because of the Arrhenius principle, the fermions will occupy all the energy levels up to the so-called Fermi energy, epsilon L. And in momentum space, this means that they will apply states up to momentum equal to pf. At a very low temperature, it happens that the fermions, which are inside the Fermi sphere, cannot scatter because they don't have fixed space available for scattering. This means that only the fermions which are in this region, the region which is close to the Fermi surface, can really interact. Let me call these fermions active fermions, because these are the fermions which are relevant for the thermodynamic or any kind of properties of this system. Notice also that fermions which are here cannot interact, but also fermions which are in the Dirac sphere cannot interact, which means that antiparticles, you can think that the antiparticles are completely decoupled in the system. And this suddenly gives you the idea why you have QQ pairs here and Q bar Q here. Because, of course, you are filling the Fermi sphere, so you don't have antiparticles anymore. So the only bound state that you can form is a QQ state. So in this picture, I don't have any kind of interaction, so this is just Fermi liquid, and it will have Fermi liquid properties. I mean, there's not any attractive interaction. Now, suppose that PF is much larger than the lambda QCD. So I can study this system implying some effective theory or perturbative matrix. What is superconductivity? There's a Cooper theorem which tells us that if you have a fermionic system at very high density and low temperature, and there is an arbitrary weak interaction between the fermions, they will form Cooper pairs. Cooper pairs are correlated pairs of fermions with the total spin zero and total momentum zero. These are alike, they are similar to bosonic, but you don't have to think as a Cooper pair as really fermion-fermion object, in the sense that these Cooper pairs are really far apart. These two fermions that form a Cooper pair are far apart. So the correlation length, which characterizes the Cooper pair, is in BCS superconductor, much larger than the average distance. Increasing the coupling, it happens that the correlation length becomes smaller and smaller, and then you go in so-called EEC, Bose-Einstein condensate, which is currently studied in cold atoms experiments. And you find that the correlation length becomes of the order region smaller than the average distance, so you really have a molecule of made of two fermions. But in general, these are just two correlated fermions, two fermions which are far apart. So I have now the two fermion surface, and I take the spin up and spin down fermions separately. And basically, it tells you that there is a correlation between this fermion here and the one which is on the opposite side of the fermion surface of the down, and should be this one. And then there is correlation between this one and this one and this one, and this fermion here. But of course, this is just for one, two, three, and then you have for all the fermions which are on the Fermi sphere. And Cooper said that basically at this point, the Fermi surface is gone. Indeed, all the properties of the system, which come from the fact that you have a Fermi sphere, are completely changed, which are due to the fact that you have a Fermi sphere, the properties of the system are completely changed because you don't have any free fermions. Only your active fermions are forming these Cooper pairs. What happens is that, so you have this condensate made of two fermions, and there is this condensate breaks some gauge symmetries, so that depends on the theory you're studying. In standard superconductor, this is U1 electromagnetic, or it can be the gauge group of the IC3 color or IC2 color. And the other fact is that the magnetic field is expelled, and this is quite similar to the X mechanism because the breaking gauge symmetries means that some gauge bottom acquire mass. And this means that the U1 is a sample of the phonon acquires a mass. And this is the explanation of the Meissner effect, which is the exclusion of a magnetic field from a superconductor. And the other thing is about the excitation spectrum, which is now described by gas quasi particle excitation. So you don't have any more fermions. Your quasi particles, which address the behavior of the system, have a gap in their dispersion. As you see, I'm not talking about supercurrents or these other things, because a characterization of a superconductor is really in terms of this Meissner mass.
You say it has to be total spin zero, and total momentum zero is true, because that's the marginal operator. But you get spin, I mean, any Fermat gets comes up when you have spin channels that are attractive. And I'm asking that just as a bookmark for when you do the QCD case, have people explored all the various channels?
Sure. I mean, any possible channel has been solved. Because, of course, there are some dynamic. I will talk about this.
Okay.
So, color superconductivity. It's not the discovery of asymptotic freedom. I mean, there were several papers discussing the possibility of creating the QQ pairs. And for a certain amount of time, it was not so interesting because people were thinking that from a generalization group approach, that the coupling was that the value of the constant should be of the same order of the one that you find in normal superconductor, in the sense that assuming that the behavior of the gap is similar to the one that you find in U1 electromagnetic, that would have led to having a gap of the order of the KV. So which was completely, I mean, not interesting because there's no physical properties. But there has been a similar paper of Mark Alford, Frank Wilczek, and Krishna Rajagopal, and at the same time a paper by Raph, this is a group of Shura, where they find that if you study, I mean, the interaction created by instantons, then you find that the gap is actually big. You can have a very large gap. And also there is a paper of Song which explains that even if you employ one room exchange, then you find that the gap is actually much larger than the one that you were expecting because chromomagnetic interactions are not screened in the system. And they are Landau damping, but they are not screened. So the main features of the close-conductor is the fact that there's a quark condensate, QQ, because there is an interaction in the 3-bar channel which is attractive. So of course, 3 times 3 is 3 bar plus 6. So you have 3 bar which is attractive and 6 which is the passive channel. And so they can form actually 3 bar condensate. It is possible for this to have a spin total zero and but it's possible, it's not the only one, this is the point. The total momentum zero and spin zero. And the thing is that here you don't need to resort to the phonons. I mean, in a standard superconductor, you have the basic interaction between electrons is repulsive. In a quark superconductor, the basic interaction, which is the color interaction, is attractive. So you expect, also for this very naive argument, that the gap is to be much larger than the one that you find, comparatively with the density of the system, to the one that you find normal superconductor. And indeed, the value of the gap in the limit is in this range, 10 to 100 anything.
Sorry, and the electromagnetic interaction does not have any
It has an effect, but in a different way, in the sense that it is very, the electromagnetic interaction is relevant when you require that the system is neutral. That's the, and I will, when I will talk about stresses, talk on that.
Can I ask you a little bit, just one more thing? A, just to get, in a superconductor, the way I understand it is that you rely a little bit on the hierarchy between the basic scale and the metal, which is electrical, and the gap. And there's a wide range of scales in between where the electrons are essentially not interacting because they're on the hairy surface, so it's a fairly liquid. And it's in that analysis where all the interactions are irrelevant except for this one marginal interaction that drives the superconductivity. That's what's driving the superconductivity. But its description is in this range of scales between the high scale and the low scale where everything's almost free. But in what you're describing here, it looks like the gap is actually the same place as the microscopic scale. So that
no, it's not exactly as a. It's not as, what I want to stress is that it is not as low as in superconductor. It's if you think about basically what can help to understand this point is this. Suppose you have you study cold atoms, and you know as an example lithium 7, and you can tune the interaction by flashback resonance, as is done in normal cold atom experiments. So suppose this is a G or 1 over A, say this where this S-wave scattering length. Basically, suppose this is delta mu normalized in some way. I didn't already introduce this thing, but so suppose we take delta mu equals 0, and we study how this this thing changes as I tune the interaction by the flashback resonance. So what I found is that let me say that this is 1 over G. So this is the VCS, because usually it is stated in terms of scattering length, which is. So this is the VCS phase, this is the VC phase, the Bose-Einstein complex. It's not, there's no phase transition between these two guys. It's just the fact that the correlation length is much larger than the average distance, and this is instead really molecule. But there is all this region here can be described by, well, except for unitary, except for a certain point where there is an infinity long scattering length or wavelength. But you can have a superconductor with a gap, which is, and of course, as you decrease, as you increase the coupling, the gap increases because it goes as an exponential 1 minus 1g. So you're increasing the gap in this direction. So normal superconductor, I mean, the one that you usually study in thermal interaction, are here in this asymptotic region where the gap is really small. Here, so we can put actually the gap here, does that. Here the gap is increasing. You are not yet in the BEC phase. What I'm saying is that color superconductor have something like this. Indeed.
Is that statement based on a controlled approximation, or is it a guess?
No. This is mean field result. Say.
Yeah, but is that based on a mean field of the approximation in the QCD case?
No, this is called atom stuff.
Yeah.
What I'm saying. So what I wanna stress is that normal superconductor has a gap which is much really small. Instead, I mean, increasing the coupling, what is happening in the color superconductor, because there is this direct interaction feedback channel, you expect a much larger gap. And indeed, the one of these two papers, the one of the group of Schuller, was really thinking about this as a deep work state. Not like if it was a Cooper pair, but if it was a QQ molecule. Because they were thinking, oh, the gap is large, so that should be in BEC regime. But instead you can show that it is not sufficiently large to be exactly in the BEC regime. But you are in a region where the gap is large, but you are somehow, say, in this intermediate phase.
And that conclusion is drawn on a calculation, though, that is, the thing I don't understand is how robust is that conclusion? Is it based on a controlled approximation, or is it something which is
No, it's not. I mean, this is an estimate. Okay. It's an estimate, but it's physically motivated in the sense that what you would expect is that if the system can form really a bound state in from a meson and not a dipole, I mean, it's like, this is my personal opinion, and also other people share this opinion. If the system can really form a bound state, it's from a QQ bar constant. Because the thing is that, as you increase the coupling, also the chemical potential goes down. So the gap goes up, and indeed, in the BEC, in the BEC, you find that the chemical potential becomes negative. And that indicates the formation of a bound state, because the bonding energy proportion of the chemical. So you are somehow, in my opinion, that you are in these intermediate regions. For other people, you are instead in the B's. But then, I mean, why shouldn't the system form a Q bar Q if the Fermi surface is gone because mu is equal to zero? So what does it prevent the system forming a Q bar Q? So that's the point. Okay. So the way of studying the system, okay, if you are in the high density limit, of course you can employ, as an example, one Lewis change, or you can also employ instanton interaction. What I will do here is just to use a local NAMU-UNJL model, which is a four Fermi interaction, a local four Fermi interaction. And so you have the free Lagrangian, which is given by this guy up there, and where mu is this complicated object that I now will describe. But first, let me say that this is for the interaction that can drive the formation of a Cooper phase. So this is the only interaction present in the system, and these gamma matrices are object in the color and flavor and with the Dirac indices. The chemical potential has this particular structure here, because what I want to do with the system is also to impose a neutrality with respect to color and electric charge. So I introduce the Lagrangian multipliers for the magnetic charge, and also for T3 and T8. In principle, I should introduce, of course, also mu1, mu2, I mean, for all the gauge fields. But one can show that these other chemical potentials are small and they reflect this tiny. So one can only include the diagonal in color and flavor chemical potentials. So let me now I do a bit fast. And in mu field, not only NGL but also mu field. So we are doing. We are putting layers and layers of approximation in our study. So in mu field, you can write Lagrangian. It's like the Hilbert-Sultanovich model, but I've not integrated out the fermionic fields yet. And here is missing. This is the conjugate one, the Hermitian conjugate one. But there is also another term, which is of like a delta delta, which comes from mu field, which is missing in that Lagrangian. But this is the important part, because. Now, what I want to stress is that since it has to be three bar channel, it has to be anti-symmetric in color. And if I want to spin zero, this has to be anti-symmetric in the flavor. If I want to spin one, I need more freedom. I can have also pairing between fork of the same flavor. This is the other. This has been studied, but the fact is that the gap is much smaller. So the only you are motivated to use the tensors only when you have the splitting between Fermi surfaces is huge, in the sense that if you, and I will explain this, if you have a huge splitting between Fermi surfaces, it costs free energy to have a Cooper pair. In that case, of course, it can be favorable to form same flavor cones.
So people know that the phase diagram is more complicated than that. There might not be. The spin one channel, for instance, is energetically disfavored. So that you really do expect just that one big part of the CSC thing in your picture, not a whole bunch of stuff.
Sure, stuff. Sure. It is. I mean, it's very complicated. But the point is what drives is the mismatch between Fermi surfaces. Because that's the key point, in the sense that if I, and there is a mechanism which I will show, which is due to the strange quark mass. So let's use this very simple ansatz, which is delta E T diagonal. So you have, even with this, you have still freedom of choosing this matrix, delta I K. So more general ansatz have been studied in this paper with Andrea Schmidt and Krishna. And but they find basically that you not gain much with more complicated answers. Actually, these are basically these three are the most energetically favored phases. It's a bit more complicated because of the splitting from the synthesis. So the three basic phases are the so-called CFL phase, studied by Frank, Mark, and Krishna, and where all the three gaps are equal and, of course, positive. Then there is the so-called gapless or GCFL phase of Mark, Krishna, and Chris Kubaris, where the three gaps are different. And there is the other one where two gaps are zero, one and zero, and this leads to QSC or G2SC phase. I will discuss GCFL in a moment. Okay, this is the breakdown to give you the idea of this white is called the color flavor phase, because of course the constant breaks SU3 color times SU3 left times SU3 right. So I'm taking MS exactly equal to zero in this thing. So I have SU3 left times SU3 right. This is called color flavor locking because the only symmetry which is unbroken is a global symmetry, which is a rotation of color and flavor simultaneously. So you don't have so there is a completely, I mean the SU3 color is completely broken, so you have eight massive gate bosons, so all the gluons acquire mass. Different, the QSC phase is different because SU3 is broken down to SU2. So you have an interesting case where you have three gluons which are massless and five gluons which acquire mass with this Higgs mechanism. So let me now go to stressing a superconductor. What we mean by stressing a superconductor? Suppose now that in some way you can produce a difference between chemical potential between the two fermions, like between up and down quarks. And in normal superconductor, this can be a Zeeman effect. In this case, will be produced as we show by the strength of mass. Then it is known that in the weak coupling, there's this closing limit, which says that the system will make a first-order transition to the BCS phase, to the normal phase, if the chemical potential is sufficiently large, larger than delta naught over square root of 2. The reason is that when you form a Cooper pair, you get an energy, I mean, free energy of which is proportional to delta. But when you have a splitting between fermion surfaces, to form a Cooper pair, you have to promote one quark, one fermion, from one fermion surfaces to, say, in an intermediate state. And the other thing, the opposite thing happened for the other one. So basically, you lose an energy proportional to delta mu. This means that as you increase delta mu, the system will prefer, at a certain point, to stay in the normal phase. And it's clear that you will lose an energy proportional to delta mu and gain an energy proportional to delta from the phase. So there must be a point where the system prefers to go to the, I mean, for large enough, the delta mu prefers to go to the normal phase. And this is exactly what the Clausen limit says. This square root of 2 is just from weak coupling. But there is what we want to stress is that there is a point where for delta mu, for a sufficiently large delta mu, the system prefers the normal phase. There are several possibilities then. I mean, because one can say, OK, it makes a first transition to the normal phase, let's say. But one can try to see if there is there are other possible superconductive phases which can be allowed. And indeed, there are. I mean, there is, first of all, this phase separation. And this is relevant for cold atoms experiments. It basically says that the system prefers to push away from the center of the trap. The system is in a trap and basically prefers to push from the center the excess atoms. So it keeps the density of the two fermions equal in the center and in such a way that it can form a superconductor and pushes out of the center of the trap the excess fermions. This would be very interesting as something in the core of a neutral star, but unfortunately it's not possible. Because for a color superconductor, this means that you will have a huge color field because your objects, of course, have color degrees of freedom, and that has a huge amount, a huge cost in terms of free energy. The other possibility is to deform the surface, means there is some interaction that can do that. It's actually that they touch in some point. This has been proposed by Newton and Mrs. Racket. And then there is there's the Bridgen pair of Michael and Frank Richard, many people working on this subject, which says that basically there's a bridge somewhere. And so in this region, there's no Cooper pair, but then these fermions can jump here. And this has been proposed many times, many years ago by Sarma, and then shown to be unstable. Indeed, it is unstable also in the case of color superconductor. Finally, there is this LOF phase, which comes from Larkin of Chimney of Fuldenfeld. It's the phase of non-isotropic superconductor proposed in the 60s. And I will deal in detail with the LOF. So what drives the mismatch between Fermi surfaces in a color superconductor? Well, suppose that you require that your system is neutral with respect to color and electromagnetic charge. Then you have some relations between the Fermi momentum and the chemical potential of the system. Suppose that Ms is equal to zero. Then, and this is so the so-called CFL. Then you find that you can have a neutral system imposing that mu E is equal to zero. Indeed, if you expand this relation, you impose neutrality, you find that mu E is proportional to Ms squared over 4 mu. So the Fermi momenta are split. They have different values, which are proportional to the strange Planck mass. This can be explained, I mean, in a very simple way. Suppose you start with a system which is neutral, and then you turn on the strange Planck mass. Then this means that the Fermi momentum will reduce. Then you need electrons to neutralize the system. And this is exactly what is happening here. Of course, if Ms is equal to zero, there's no splitting. I'm not talking, I mean, there's also another argument about the color choice, but let's stick to the electromagnetic one. So, I've shown you that there is a Clausen limit. There is also a Clausen limit in the string for color superconductor. So let's go back to the basic answers, which is delta IK diagonal in this index IK. And let me stress that delta 1 as an example describes pairing between D and S quark, meaning D green and S blue, and S and D quark, S green and D blue. So delta I, in general, describes pairing between quarks whose flavor and color is not I. So as an example, 1, this is 2 and 3. The GCFL answer so is physically motivated by the fact that when I increase the splitting between the Fermi surface, I can expect that it will be energetically convenient for the system to have pairing between some fermions, but not energetically convenient to have between other fermions. And but if the splitting coefficient is more, I have something similar to the Clausen limit. So the CFL is stable for a splitting between Fermi surfaces, which is driven by Ms, which is less than some value, which is, in this case, 2 times delta naught. Then there is a window of values between 2 delta naught and lambda, where lambda depends on the value of delta naught, where the GCFL, so you have 3 different gaps, is favored. Then if I have a very large mismatch between Fermi surfaces, it is not energetically capable to have any kind of pairing. And another example, for delta naught, the Baucus lambda, for delta naught equal 25 MeV, which is the window which I will be using at this moment on, I find lambda of 135 MeV. So what is the GCFL? Well, this is from the paper of Mark Krishna and Chris Kuvaris. Basically, you find that delta 1, which is fast pairing between, so the Fermi surfaces are now like this. So there is a S, U, and D. Delta 1 describes pairing between these two guys, which are far apart. And indeed, you find that delta 1 goes down. The splitting is not symmetric because of color charge. So it is an energetically convenient, I mean, to have a large delta 3 gap and a smaller delta 2 gap between these fermions. So delta 3 describes UD, because these are closer, and US is styled by S. It is gapless because there are some zeros in the dispersion law of some quasi particles. As an example, for GSVD quasi particle, there are two points where the dispersion law is zero. For the RSBU, there is one quadratic, and the two solutions have the same. It's like if these two solutions have collapsed, and it is quadratic at this point. This is not new. I mean, this result, I mean, is new in the for quantum data, but was not. It's not something new for standard superconducting, because this is very similar to what was called the summer phase, and it was amazing because it's an amazing phase because you have both properties. It is a superconducting because it is a Manhattan mass, but it is it's like a fluid liquid because it's this linear dispersion relation. About the Manhattan mass, we have shown that actually there is a problem, a huge problem here. Indeed, if you compute the Meissner mass as a function of quadratic Meissner mass as a function of MS, you find that for MS equals zero, the non-CFL result, which is this is a weak coupling result. But if you try to compute the Meissner mass and this is my paper with Roberto Casalboni and the Italian group. Then you find that, and there's also this other interesting paper of Alford, you find that the Meissner mass is actually negative. So I told you that for MS square over mu of order 2 delta naught, you phase transition to the CFL phase. It's a quantum phase transition because it's equal to 0 phase transition. But then you find that the Meissner mass, quadratic Meissner mass, becomes negative. So the system is unstable. And this is so-called chromomagnetic instability. And it has an analog in normal superconductor because there is the number susceptibility which becomes negative in that case. And you can show that there is a relation between these two quantities. This is for some of the gluons, but also the other gluons present some problem at different values of MS, of the splitting between the Fermi surfaces.
Is the gaplessness robust? Is that massless point something which is protected by a symmetry or something? It's gapless, you said, because the gap kind of in something as functional momentum goes down and touches zero. But is that a symmetry understanding as to why it's zero at that point? If I perturb the system, is it going to stay zero?
Yeah, there is. There is a possibility of some way. Not let me go to that. We can discuss that later. So let's go to the loft in two flips. So I will explain this pressing two flip, then I turn to three flip. Please. So for two flip, it was first studied by these guys, Larkin, Chenko, Fulton, and Ferrer. And they find that basically there is a window where between delta V1 and delta V2 where the phase with the non isotopic condensate is free. By non isotopic, I mean something, I mean, this is the quark of Fermi fermion. Expectation value, which is now no more a constant, but it has this function which modulates the constant in space. What does it mean? It means that basically what you are saying is that now delta mu is larger than the clock solid. I can form Cooper pairs, but I have to pay a price for that. My Cooper pair will not have zero momentum. And this means that only some fermions can pair to form Cooper pairs. So, as an example, let's suppose that this is the zeta axis, so that this is QQ, and this QQ will be the total momentum of the Cooper pairs. So, suppose and the direction of Q in this simple case is spontaneously chosen by the system, but the value of Q can be determined by free energy minimization. So, what happens is that for a certain value of Q, I will have basically two rings where pairing can take place. Or two ribbons, because of course there is some width around the Fermi surface where pairing can take place. And it is very interesting because this means that the dispersion law of the two quasi particles is gapless, but it's not isotropic. So there is a breaking of space symmetry. In this case, there is still an O2 around the direction of spontaneously chosen by the system. And you can show that this phase is energetically favored with respect to the normal phase in that tiny, which is really tiny, in weak up region. Now, let's go directly to the three flavor log phase. And now I assume that not only, I mean, why should I take just one plane wave? So, I mean, I can take one Q in this direction, and I can add another plane wave in the orthogonal direction of one sample, or in many different directions in principle. And so I will study a structure where there is a sum over possible plane waves. Now, this what does this index mean? It means that take the delta 1 as an example. I have a set of vector Q1A, which determine, I mean, this is the usual column flavor structure, which determine a crystalline phase. Why a crystal and not, say, in any possible direction? Why I want to make a crystal with this plane waves? The reason is that I will describe that in a moment. Just let me use one assumption, is that the Fermi, since it's known that the log phase, at least for one wave, a second order phase transition to the normal phase, I can use, as a first approximation, the Fermi momentum which I get from the normal phase. So I'm assuming that delta is small, so it is a small effect on the Fermi momentum. And I take for PF the same values of the normal phase. Now, why I can tell that the crystal is the favorite solution for this stuff? Well, let's study two plane waves. So we started with one, now let's go to two. For two plane waves, it is possible to study this structure without employing the Gibbs-Landau approximation. And the reason is that, I mean, when you have a gap of that sort, you have an inverse propagator which cannot be inverted. So you don't have the propagator of the theory. And this means that you cannot contribute the energy on the system. But if you have two plane waves, it is possible with a trick to diagonalize the inverse propagator. The trick has to do with what I named the non-standard HDT decomposition. And basically, forget about this now. You're making a shift of the Fermi surfaces. So if suppose you have two plane waves, and you have that delta 2 and delta 3 are equal, and equal to delta, and so they come with the factor E2i, E2 times x. If I make a shift of the fermionic fields, this means that I'm heading K1 from psi 1 and K3 from psi 3. The same is here for K1 and K2. So I can eliminate this space dependence simply choosing QQ equal to K1 plus K3 and QQ3 equal to K1 plus K3. This is not doesn't solve the problem. I mean, in the sense that you're taking something from the so-called off-diagonal part of the Nambu-Gorkov propagator, which is a quantity which I have not defined, and you're putting the diagonal part. This means that basically you are making, simplifying the problem in the sense you're putting in this anisotropy in a way that you can treat that. This is what is meant by this. What is happening here is that what I'm doing is a shift of Fermi surfaces. This is the only thing that I'm doing. Now, these are the S, U, and D Fermi surfaces. These are in the HDT. How much time I have for?
So officially, you have
2 minutes.
Yeah. Minutes. How much?
Because I want. Okay, 10 minutes. Okay. Okay. So the thing is that. In this approach, basically, I define velocity. It's like HPT. If you have HPT in mind, this is very similar to that. I will describe velocity, I mean, direction-dependent field. That's the thing. Here is V, the vector. And there are similar, I mean, HPT is very similar in this sense. that there is a, there is one direction, which is the direction of Fermi velocity, which is which determines basically the property of the Fermi fields. Let's put this in English. So, and there is a pairing between the fermions which have opposite velocity. So, fermions with velocity minus v will pair with the fermions with velocity v, or u will pair with s, which has opposite velocity. So, it's like if I've done I turn the Fermi surfaces for the u quark. I make a reflection of the Fermi with respect to the center. Now, let's go to the tree flavor, so to the shifted fields. In this case, I have shifted the so of course this this equation has several solutions. Suppose we are dealing with q1 equal q2 equal q, equal q. Then I have of course several possibilities because these are two equations in two in three unknowns, so I can arbitrarily move the system. I can arbitrarily move the Fermi surfaces, but the solution does not depend on that because I will get the same value of the free energy. And you can graphically see it because, as a sample, I make a shift of Q2 of the dominant strange Fermi surface, and I have pairing in the region where the various Fermi surfaces overlap, which is here and here. But the similar thing happens if I take Q1 equal to Q, and then, I mean, I have this, it's like translating all the thing up. It's just you're making an overall shift of the Fermi surface of the system. I will skip pairing regions, and let me go to this. So what happens here is that in this system, for two-plane waves, I have only two parameters. The first one is the gap, because I'm assuming that the gap, the splitting between Fermi surfaces are equal, so there's only pairing between us and ud. And since delta 1, which respects ds pairing, is much smaller, I completely taking, I taking it to equal to 0. So I pair it between us and ud. So, and I'm taking this gap to be equal. This gap lambda to be equal. Then I have delta, which is this gap, and phi, the angle between the two plane waves that I have in my system. So there's the angle between these two guys, which is another problem. And I have to minimize respect to that. And I'm calling this, this angle phi. This is the gap as a function of phi. The various line, the continuous line are the result of a Ginzburg-Landau simulation for small values of delta, and which is a you can see from the, and the dot line are instead the calculation without from Ginzburg-Landau. You can see that for small delta the two solutions are the same. Well, I mean here for very small delta there are some problems with these large angles. And this is as a function of it. So for phi equals 0, which means opposite direction, the gap is larger. And also the free energy is large. As you increase the angle, the free energy reduces. Actually, it is, you see that the other values is very large, 2 pi over 3. So it is independent on the angle for up to 2 pi, almost 2 pi over 3. And then it decreases. This happens because there is overlap between the pairing regions of different condensates. So, why crystal is favored? Because the crystal minimizes the overlap between the pairing regions. It's like having what I'm saying here is that I have a pairing region here between D and U, and then I can only put, if I put a large overlap here, this is energetically disfavored. It's energetically favored instead to have a ring which goes like this, which means that I have to solve this problem. I have a ring which is a certain opening angle, which is 60, I mean, can be determined like 67 degrees, and I have to put as many rings as possible on a sphere. And for this angle, the solution is 8. So a cube is probably the most favored solution.
Well, what you're describing is essentially nesting, right? If this had been a condensed matter system, you would have had nesting not because of the displacement of two Fermi surfaces, but it would have been because it had a funny shape or something. So you had a translation vector that takes part of the surface to my surface. And then what this is special because you're saying that someone has to choose if it's on the overlap of two rings. Is that
right? I mean, having in the same place as double pairing reduces the free energy in the same direction, which is reasonable, which is very reasonable. Okay, so the crystal. What is Rishi and Krishna have found that there are two basic structures which are called cubex and qq cosified zeta, which are energetically filled. And both you see the name q because of what I told you before, that actually is an energetically filled group. I mean, these rings have certain opening angle that the cube is somehow the filled structure. And they find there are two basic solutions. The first one is called cubex because there are remember two composites, which are delta q and delta 3. I'm taking delta 1 equal to 0. And q2 is a set of vectors which determine the crystal structure associated with delta 2. And q3 are the vectors which determine the same quantity for delta 3. The cubex is this structure here, where you have the purple rectangle describes the region where the q2 vectors are, and the orange or whatever it is describes the region where the q3 vectors lies. And this is the way in which you minimize the overlap between this. It's one of the solutions. The other solution has a minimal overlap, but it's still energetically favored in a certain range of mismatch, and it's so-called q cube 45 zeta. Basically, the vectors q and q3 determine two cubes. And the way to minimize the overlap is to rotate one cube with respect to the other from 45 degrees with respect to a C4x of the cube, in this case, zeta x. And this point here are the intersection between x, y, and zeta axis with the cube, with the rotated cube. So, what is the free energy? Well, for the tube-length waves, you find that so this is as a function of the mismatch, and this is the difference of free energy with respect to the unpaired format. You find that the CFA is energetically favored up to roughly 50 MeV, because I've taken delta naught equal to 25 MeV. Then you have the transition to the so-called GCFL phase, which, however, is dashed because it's not stable. And you can see this time region here, which is shown more detailed here, that the tube-length waves is favored with respect to GCFL and with respect to the normal phase in a very tiny region. But of course, this is because it's tube-length waves. Now, what happens if I put on more plane waves? So there are several structures here, and just focus on these two, cubex and q45. This is the phase, the same diagram. CFL, GCFL, and then you have that the free energy here is much smaller than CFL and the normal phase. But this is, however, a result of minimum point gauge for lambda, which means a small delta, and delta is not small here. However, you can assume that, but this is the best that we can do now. There's no methods to deal with such complex structure without employing an expansion in depth. It's the only way in which we can handle this problem. And it is reliable in the sense that it's physically motivated, let's put it in this way. So once you have this crystal, this is the last topic, what we want to do is to study the fluctuation of this crystal. Let me introduce it as a displacement field called UIX, which basically describes the form. So I'm taking my crystal and I'm assuming that it can oscillate. And this is possible because space symmetries are broken. So yeah, I expect Goldstone bosons associated to the breaking of spatial symmetries. And so you bosonize the system introducing these forms, and then you integrate out the fermionic degrees of freedom as usually one does. And you end with this at leading order in delta square. You end up with this Lagrange. And where you have the kinetic part and you have the potential part, which comes from which has this very peculiar structure. I remind you that QIA are the vectors, A runs from 1 to n in principle. In our case, we run from 1 to 8, in general for the cube, or 1 to 4 for the cubex. And I runs from is equal to 2 or 3 because it is connected with the cones, delta 2 and delta 3. So, why is this useful? Because from this action, you can obtain the shear modulus. The shape modulus, I mean, is a part of the elastic tensor, which describes the elastic properties of the system. So, it's, of course, if you take a sample of your material, you can shrink it or you can make it slack, making the faces of the crystal slack. The shear modulus, this will be the compression, it will be proportional to the fluctuations, which are diagonal, say, in this, in the, I mean, they will have all the space indices equal. And the shear will be instead the, so, will be instead of the off diagonal part of this tensor. To be more, I mean, graphically, it's easier to explain this. Suppose I have a strain acting on a face of my element of a system. And this is the y, and the faces which is orthogonal to the y direction. So sigma yy describes the compression acting on this face. Sigma yz and yx describe the strain. I mean, describe the tangential stress. And the shear is basically proportional with the stress over the strain. That is the stress of the deformation in non-diagonal, which I mean yy direction. That is the shear modulus of the system. And you can read this from the formula graph, because of course it describes the fluctuations of the system. And you find, basically, that it is of order mu squared delta squared, which is this guy which is in front of everything. And you find that this guy is much larger than the value that you typically find in a neutron star with a lattice made of like iron lattice. Why is this? The crystalline of phase has a very interesting property because it is a solid, and it is also superfluid because U1 baryonic is broken in the system, so you have a superfluid mode in this system. And this is my last slide. So now we are aiming at stars. We are aiming at explaining some phenomena that take place in stars. We know that the neutron stars spin down because they emit angular momentum, and that once in a while they have these glitches which are jumping the frequency of rotation of the star. So if this is the spinning velocity of the star, the angular velocity of the star, it usually goes down like this. But once in a while they jump over the delta omega naught, which is related to omega, I mean, which are really tiny. And then it relaxes back to the behavior which it should have had without having such a glitch. These glitches can occur in days or years, typically in years, as a sample. And they are not big in the sense that, as a sample for the beta, this is, ratio is really tiny, 10 to the minus 6. But it seems that any neutron star, I mean, any pulsar, experiences glitches. So you have to find a way that, I mean, it's not that it has been proven that any pulsar, but it's compatible with any pulsar, that any pulsar has glitches. It's compatible with the experimental result that we have. You know. Two basic things are important for having such a phenomenon. So if you wanna build a model for neutron star, first of all, you have to explain glitches. This is the point. And usually, a usual cosmic conductive method cannot explain pulsars. I mean, if you're assuming that your star is just made of color superconductor, where does the crystal come from for having such a phenomenon? Indeed, there are two things which are very important for having such a thing. It's a superfluid vortex, and there is the fact that this vortex has to be pinned to a structure. Indeed, that will explain, I mean, very briefly the mechanism for glitches. Basically, you have that, you know that density of vortices, of superfluid vortices, is proportional to the angular momentum of the system, because each vortex carries a unit of angular momentum. So as the star spins down, this is a vortex would like to go out, going to the surface of the star. But this is not possible, because usually they are pinned to the lattice, which forms the crust of the star. I'm speaking very naively here. However, what happens is that they are pinned so they cannot move outward. But of course, the stress which acts on this vortex increases because the magnetic force would like to push this guy up. Now, when the magnetic force is larger than the pinning force, there will be the first one will go down, and then there will be an avalanche of these vortices because they interact with each other. And this explains, this is one of the possible explanations of the glitches for running. So what you need is a crust and you need a superfluid. And block phase has both of that. I mean, it has both crust because it has a system which is solid, and it has a U1 baryonic superfluid vortex. So both of these things are present. In the non-log phases, you don't have a rigid body. So there's no way that you can pin this one. They perform an abrigos of lattice, but as you turn down, as the star goes down, they will move out. So we will never observe these glitches, this increase of angular momentum. There must be a way of storing angular momentum inside of the star. So my conclusions. I showed you that homogeneous gapless phases are, in most cases, unstable. At least they are unstable when the mismatch difference is sufficiently large. And in cold atoms, this leads usually to the phase separation between atoms of different spin. But this is not probably possible in quark matter, at least in three-level quark matter. Where one possibility is the lottery. There are other possibilities, but Cicero Prodomo-Sua, I've talked mainly about the log phase. And the three-level phase is a crystal and a superfluid. So I cannot call it superfluid crystal because it has already been used in literature for describing completely different systems. So I quoted it like this way. Then this suggests the possibility that some glitches can come from the core of neutron stars. Of course, this has many problems, like how does the angular momentum transfer from the superconductor to the crust, because that's what we see with crust. I mean, I'm talking about hybrid neutron stars where they have a superconductive core and crust. How does the angular momentum transfer from the core? There are many problems which are not solved. We did not even build a real vortex inside our lens. This is just up to now, it's just a conjecture. But nevertheless, we have the basic evidence for having glitches in corresponding stars. OK, thanks a lot.
So, in your time, one urgent question is why
the question was, so it's nice you got a solid phase, and I wasn't sure what the dial was that puts you into that phase. You had density, you had temperature, you had this strange quark mass, which is just some number, divided by mu, and I was mu density again? What do I have? Where in that phase diagram is this?
Mu is baryon chemical potential. Oh, the thing is that you are talking about the phase diagram.
You start off.
Yeah, you would like to know now the relation between MS and mu, yeah. Basically, right? Because our phase diagram is, where is it? It should be here. Okay, here it is. Our phase diagram is, the thing is that you should set consistently evaluate the strange quark mass with some interaction, like, I don't know, some channel of NJL and some. The thing is that we are using MS as a parameter. So we are.
But you have to kind of draw a cartoon. So you have to have
the. Where is it? I don't know.
No idea at all?
No, we have an idea. We have an idea that. As you decrease density, you are going from CFF, which is here. You are going. I mean, density is not proportional to mu, but I mean, mu is a measure of the density of the system. So you are decreasing. Assume that MS remains the same. It's not true. So I'm decreasing the density, and moving this way, or better here, I'm moving this way. Then if there is still the confined quark matter in the system, and it can form a log vortex.
So that would be somewhere in your red region.
We show that basically, if you use a quark mass of 100 to 500 MeV, which is like the current and the constituent value, you find that basically you can cover a huge region with the log phase. You can cover from basically the transition, which is let's say around 400 MeV for a quark chemical potential, up to 1,000. So it's a huge region where the log phase can be. It's not that
if you go far enough out, then you're in
like CFL. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, asymptotic density, we know that it's CFL.
Very good. Any further questions?
I'm sorry, because it's late.
Okay, let's thank Constantine again.